Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The White Ladder, Triumph and Tragedy at the Dawn of Mountaineering, by Daniel Light. Narrated by Richard Trinder. We attacked the wall immediately after starting, making short and frequent halts for rest and breath, as we trod silently the white ladder of approach to the mysterious unknown. Fanny Bullock Workman, 1909. Author's note. The notion that early European mountain explorers were lone, pioneering figures endures even today. In truth, every expedition included those whose names and identities were not a matter of record, who kept no account of their experiences or whose stories have been lost. Theirs were the shoulders the Europeans stood on. Theirs were the backs they broke. I have tried to do justice to the part played by these local intermediaries. I give their names where I have been able to discover them. I make as full an account of their involvement as sources allow. At the same time, I sometimes employ the same shorthand as the sources themselves. I use Baltis, Botias, and Lepchas to refer to what may have been more intermixed ethnic groups. I use porter and guide to describe roles that were more complex and multifarious. I refer to groups of men that may have included small minorities of women. The word coolie, a pejorative term for porters, appears only in direct quotations. For the names of the places we travel to and the people we meet, I favour what spellings appear most frequently in the sources I use. Some places, Bombay, for example, Calcutta and Rangoon, are referred to by their English language names at the time of the events described. It is impossible to cover such a broad sweep of history without making some mistakes. Mountaineers climb with force of personality and find plenty to disagree about, even from two ends of the same rope. Some dangers might be exaggerated, others underplayed. Some heights have been mismeasured, disputed, and revised. Some people tell barefaced lies. I have recounted the climbs as the climbers told them, leaving the listener to decide what to believe. There will be moments when this book betrays the fact that I am not a serious mountaineer. A keen climber, yes, who knows what it is to move unroped at the edge of my comfort zone, but made from nothing like the same stuff as most of the people you are about to meet. I am, I suppose, like the military historian who writes about battle without ever having gone to war, an enthusiast who loves mountains and who found, in the writing of this book, a way to always be among them. Prologue. Because it is there. Mallory was bored. Bored of giving the same old talk with the same old photographs on the same old lecture tour. Disheartened by the mixed reception on the other side of the Atlantic, by half-full venues and lacklustre reviews. And when the lights came up, always the same question. Why? Might as well ask a dog why it howls at the moon. Mallory was a climber. At 7, he'd been scampering up drainpipes on his father's church. At 12, it was the chapel of Winchester College. Mount Everest was a higher calling, of course, but at heart he was still that boy from Birkenhead, climbing like he did not expect to fall. Why? Some question for a soldier, a veteran of the Great War. Mallory had served in the Royal Artillery, had made a target of himself, scaling trees and church towers, spotting for his battery. He had gone to the trenches on reconnaissance missions, had seen bodies sinking into Picardy clay. Those who had seen so much death knew life was for living. Those who had been to such depths knew mountains were for climbing. Why? He had a family to think about. He and Ruth had married 6 days before Britain entered the war. The children barely knew him. Why disappear into the mountains when everything that mattered most was back home. Except, Mallory didn't know how to be a husband or a father, any more than he knew how to be a soldier or a teacher. The only thing that came naturally to him was to climb. But why? Why put yourself in such danger? Because it was dangerous. 7 men had died on the last Everest expedition, Sherpas killed in an avalanche. For many, they were just porters, indigenous intermediaries pressed into the service of the British. Mallory knew them as skilled guides and mountaineers, men with their own understanding of what it meant to walk in Everest's shadow. They had names: Dorje, Lakpa, Norbu, Pasang, Pima, Sange, and Temba. They had families. Mallory blamed himself. He had led them into trouble. They shouldn't have been on the mountain so late in the summer. Then a weather window opened, tempting good mountaineers into bad decisions. So much experience among the British, Everest made novices of them all. Now there was talk of having another go. Why? Because they almost had it. George Finch and Geoffrey Bruce had gone to within 2,000 feet of the summit, until Everest was the only mountain they could see without turning our gaze downwards. Exhausted, with time against them, a malfunction with their oxygen equipment turned them back. But for one stroke of bad luck, they might have climbed the world's highest mountain. How could they give up now? "So," said the reporter, a young lady from the New York Times, "why exactly is it that you want to climb?" Mallory sighed. "Go ask the past. Go ask the pioneers. Go ask the mercenaries and spies risking their lives, wearing disguises so good they fooled themselves. Ask soldiers and surveyors laboring through the lowlands, forcing frozen passes in the stamping ground of somebody else's gods. Ask the alpinists and cragsmen, showmen and charlatans, peasants and princes, writing their names into record books and sometimes into stone. Ask the amateurs and professionals, ask them all, who first clapped eyes, set hearts, fixed hands on the highest mountains in the world. Go ask the past. Demand your truth from visionaries and seers. Then listen as their answers echo back across the years." Part 1. All they surveyed. And all the time, there it was ahead of them. Chapter 1. Under a Foreign Sky. "I hold out to you a glorious prize," Don Hernan Cortes told his assembled forces, "but it is to be won by incessant toil. Great things are achieved only by great exertions." That was the conquistador's promise, as he and his followers prepared to sail for the place they called Yucatan. The year was 1519, the glorious prize in question, Aztec Mexico. Cortes had mustered his army on the shore at Cuba's Cape Corrientes, a force of around 500 Spanish soldiers accompanied by several hundred native Cubans. A fleet of 11 ships lay just offshore, loaded with horses, assorted weapons and artillery, and as much cassava bread and salt pork as he'd been able to lay in stock. Cortes was not a tall man. By some accounts he stood at just 5'4", but since being appointed Captain General of the Armada, he had taken to wearing a hat with a large plume of feathers. This was complemented by a black velvet coat with golden knots and a gold medallion, heralding the glittering promise of great riches waiting just across the opal sea. Cortes was true to his word. Battered by a violent storm, they made land at Yucatan to be faced by hostile Mayan warriors vastly outnumbering them. Arrows and spears were no match for the fiery lightning of Spanish cannon and musket, but for Cortes and his exhausted army, victory brought no respite. Making camp on the burning sands of the Tierra Caliente, they were tormented by swarms of parasitic insects. The heat was unbearable, but Cortes insisted his soldiers keep their armor on at all times. Even when they slept, it was with weapons at hand. Marching east into the snow-clad mountains of the Cordillera, the Spanish were ambushed by their enemies and besieged by cold. This, though, was life in the army of Cortes, a general whose mantra was, "Succeed or perish." Upon hearing that some of his soldiers were considering retreat, their patience exhausted by a life of fatigue and peril, the conquistador acted decisively. He sent back orders to sink their own ships. Then, just as they were beginning to despair, a vision appeared to stir their cavalier spirits, a thin column of smoke rising from a mountain's summit. Drawing closer, they saw the smoke coming from within the mountain. High on Mexico's Sierra Nevada, it was the 17,694-foot stratovolcano Popocatépetl. Many of the Spanish had never seen an active volcano before. Transfixed by the wild terrors which hung over the spot, and possessed by the wild love of adventure, a decorated captain named Diego de Ordaz saw an opportunity to further enhance his reputation. He went to Cortes and begged leave to ascend the mountain to inspect this wonder more minutely. Cortes sensed an opportunity of his own. He had been manipulating local factions from the moment they made land at Yucatan, gaining their allegiance, then turning them against one another. Now he would show that no achievement was above the dauntless daring of his followers, for whom the most appalling and mysterious perils were as pastimes. With some of the Tlaxcalans as their guides, Ordaz and a small party of Spaniards started towards the volcano. They passed through dense forest, the pine trees mutilated and misshapen, scarred by debris from past eruptions. Then there were no trees at all, only shrubs and stunted vegetation, as they moved on to the slopes of Popocatépetl. A black surface of glazed volcanic sand and lava arrested in a thousand fantastic forms. As if awoken by the footsteps troubling its lower reaches, the volcano began to stir. According to the Spanish, the Tlaxcalans believed Popocatépetl to be the abode of the departed spirits of wicked rulers, whose fiery agonies in their prison house caused the fearful bellowings and convulsions in times of eruption. Now, hearing these strange subterranean sounds, the local guides decided they would go no further. There is no way of knowing whether, to the minds of the Tlaxcalans, the noise they heard was indeed the anguish of vengeful souls trapped in a prison of fire. Just as it befitted the Catholic conquistadors to see their indigenous counterparts as fearful and superstitious, with a homeland waiting to be claimed for the Holy Roman Emperor and his one true God, it well suited the Tlaxcalans not to climb an active volcano. Putting such questions, and their guides, behind them, the Spanish went on alone. Mist closed in, and smoke drifted down to join it. Gone was the sky, the bright sunlight, the sprawling tableland beneath. It grew colder as they passed the snow line, and the rocky mountainside disappeared beneath a thick coating of ice and snow. Wrapped in cloud, they had entered a white world, where a false step might precipitate them into the frozen chasms that yawned around. Their quilted cotton armor insulated them against the gathering cold, Their steel helmets and cuirasses afforded some protection against volcanic debris or a serious fall, but armour weighed heavily at 17,000 feet and more, where breathing grew difficult, every effort attended with sharp pains in the head and limbs. Ordaz urged them on. Then, with the lip of the crater visible above, the volcano burst into life. It began to throw out great tongues of flame. Such volumes of smoke, sparks, and cinders belched forth from its burning entrails and driven down the sides of the mountain as nearly suffocated and blinded them. They had reached the last circle of hell, except here the circles rose upwards. Two lances distant from the summit, they could go no further. At the last they turned back. "They went and strove and did all that was possible to scale it," wrote Cortes in a letter to the Holy Roman Emperor, "but never were able to do so." He might have given them a little more credit. Ordaz had brought back more than just a tale of high adventure from the near summit of Popocatépetl. He had looked deep into the homeland of the Aztec ruler Montezuma. Cortes could now lead his army over the high mountain pass to the north, approaching the city of Tenochtitlan with the element of surprise. "They came back very glad at having discovered such a road," wrote Cortes, "and God knows how happy I was about it." Ordaz had observed something else high on the slopes of Popocatépetl, the foul smell of sulphur dioxide emanating from the crater. Sulphur, Ordaz knew, was necessary for the production of gunpowder, and gunpowder was necessary for the waging of war. When their supplies ran short, Cortes would send another of his captains, Francisco de Montaño, to the summit of Popocatépetl. To the conquistadors' delight, Montaño returned with all the sulphur they could possibly need, describing how he had been lowered into the crater to collect it. In a letter to the emperor, Cortes struck a more circumspect note. "It would be less inconvenient on the whole," he observed, "to import our powder from Spain." The ascent of Popocatépetl is not the first historically documented account of a mountain being climbed. For that, we turn to the Shu Jing, one of the oldest books in the world, to find the ruler of China, Emperor Shun, atop the highest peak of the eastern Shandong province, the 5,029-foot Mount Tai, in around 2,284 BCE. Standing on the first part of the Chinese landmass to feel the light of a new day, Shun made burnt offerings to the Jade Emperor of Heaven and gave thanks for the gifts of light and life, symbolized by the break of dawn. Other high ascents predate the Spanish on Popocatépetl. A Buddhist monk named Matsudai Shonin is known to have ascended Japan's 12,395-foot Mount Fuji in 1149 CE. Shonin was a follower of Shugendo, a Buddhist sect whose disciples, the Yamabushi, climbed as an act of ritual religious observance, an opportunity to test their faith. At the same time, thousands of miles away, Native Americans are said to have ascended mountains of 12,000 feet and more to commune with their ancestral spirits. For some, the height of the peak climbed was a measure of a young warrior's spiritual ambition. The ascent of Popocatépetl was different. From medieval times, Europeans had contemplated mountains with fear and superstition, their frozen heights the haunts of witches and the lairs of dragons, with the souls of the damned lying incarcerated in the glaciers below. A few outriders of the Enlightenment had ventured into the Alps, most famously Leonardo da Vinci. Towards the end of the 15th century, da Vinci climbed a mountain called Monboso, a spur of the Monte Rosa, where he drew sketches of the range appearing in the background of the Mona Lisa. Da Vinci, though, was ahead of the curve. In the early 16th century, Most Europeans agreed that alpine passes were to be hurried over and the mountains themselves avoided altogether. Now, on the other side of the world, Ordaz and Montaño had led attempts on a summit higher than any in Europe, not as an act of religious homage or contrition, but in the name of conquest, driven by the chimerical spirit of enterprise which glowed in the breast of the Spanish cavalier. They evoked something of the spirit of the modern-day mountaineer, which is why, 500 years later, in a chronicle of the highest ascents on record, that is where our story begins. Baron Alexander von Humboldt was asleep in his hammock when the world began to shake. The day was hot and humid, and thunderclouds had cast the Venezuelan city of Cumaná into darkness, foreshadowing the violent earthquake now rocking the city to its very foundations. Humboldt watched as his friend Aimé Bonpland was thrown to the ground. In the streets nearby, he could hear people crying out in terror. Panic was spreading fast. Humboldt rose to his feet and began to set up his instruments. He had come to South America to gain a better understanding of the inner workings of the earth. This was too good an opportunity to miss. Earthquakes were just one of the dangers Humboldt would encounter during his 5-year expedition to South America. Arriving in 1799, he and Bonpland travelled thousands of miles, taking heavily laden mules across the highest and most precipitous passes of the Andes, then venturing deep into the howling wilderness of the Amazonian rainforest. There they conducted dangerous experiments with deadly poisons and bathed in waters infested with alligators and crocodiles, giant anacondas and electric eels. In June 1802, they came within sight of the 20,549-foot Ecuadorian stratovolcano Chimborazo. Humboldt and Bonpland intended to climb it. Humboldt was fascinated with volcanoes. He envisaged nature as a single interconnected system, a web of life animated and moved by inward forces. To Humboldt, volcanoes were openings to the heart of nature, manifesting all its creative and destructive force. Now, he would take his work onto the slopes of one unmatched in reputation and stature in search of the ultimate prize, vital evidence for how the earth itself had formed. Humboldt knew the stories of the Spanish on Popocatépetl. He doubted whether they had gone into the crater or to the summit, thinking it more likely they had collected the sulphur, as several persons in Mexico suppose, from a lateral crevice of the volcano. His ascent of Chimborazo would be different. He would bring a scientific rigour to proceedings and a scientist's reputation. He would open the book on the world altitude record and close it by climbing what most Europeans then believed to be the highest mountain on earth. A painting by Friedrich Weitsch shows Humboldt and Bonpland en route to Chimborazo, camped on the grassland plains leading to its foot. Humboldt stands, inspecting an intricate brass theodolite, a telescope that reports the angle of an object from the horizontal, cradled by one of the local guides. Bonpland sits taking notes in the shade of a tree. Both men wear frock coats, loose-fitting trousers, and thin-soled shoes. Nearby, on a wooden box, is a top hat. Humboldt was nothing if not ambitious. He meant to climb Chimborazo in a single day. That night, heavy snow fell, but it did nothing to deter him. He and Bonpland were away early the next morning, accompanied by their friend Carlos Montúfar, their mestizo manservant José de la Cruz, and a party of local porters and guides. They crossed the tableland, then started up a series of giant, step-like plains, Humboldt and Bonpland riding on mules. Coming to the snow line, Humboldt understood that their guides had little sense of what lay ahead. They had chosen this route up the mountain, but few had ever reached the limit of perpetual snow. Leaving their mules, they climbed through an enchanted forest of stone, leading to the foot of a narrow ridge of rock by which alone it was possible for us to advance. The ridge looked badly weathered, narrowing to just a few inches. The locals knew it as the cuchilla, a word which means knife edge. Humboldt saw the guides and porters preparing to abandon them. The locals might visit the lower reaches of Chimborazo to hunt game or gather firewood, but they had no reason to climb the cuchilla. When all entreaties and threats were unavailing, Humboldt understood that he and his three companions were on their own. They began to climb. Soon the ridge was all there was, rising out of a sea of mist, disappearing into a canopy of cloud. "On the left, the precipice was concealed by snow," wrote Humboldt. "On the right, our view sank, shuddering 800 or 1,000 feet into an abyss. As the rock was very keenly angular, we were painfully hurt, especially in the hands." And still they went up. Occasionally, where the ridge was wide enough, they stopped to rest. Here, Humboldt measured altitude, gravity, temperature, and humidity, balancing his instruments on the rocks around him and scribbling notes with frozen and bloody fingers. Little trace of life remained, only stone lichen and moss. A butterfly, Sphinx, was caught by Monsieur Bonpland at the height of 15,000 feet, noted Humboldt. "We saw a fly 1,600 feet higher." From the slopes of other volcanoes they had looked down onto the backs of soaring condor. On Chimborazo, those were nowhere to be seen. The longer they climbed, the more they felt the effects of altitude. "We began gradually to suffer from great nausea," wrote Humboldt. "We had hemorrhage from the gums and lips. The conjunctiva of the eyes likewise was, in all, gorged with blood." The men grew giddy as the world swam around them, with no horizon to orient them, no summit to hold their gaze. All they could do was climb, up the crumbling crest of the cuchilla, hoping up was still up and down still down. Then, like that, the mist was gone, revealing the dome-shaped summit of Chimborazo. All that stood between the four men and, to the best of their knowledge, the highest position on the surface of the earth, was a distance thrice the height of St. Peter's Church in Rome. "It was an earnest, momentous gaze," wrote Humboldt, "one that animated our powers anew." The men hastened onwards with certain steps, believing the summit now within their grasp, only for fate to snatch it from them. All at once, a ravine of some 400 feet in depth and 50 broad set an insurmountable barrier to our undertaking. With no way round the giant crevasse, there was no alternative but to turn back. According to Humboldt's measurements, they had reached a height of 19,286 feet above sea level, higher than the top of Popocatépetl, higher than the highest summits of the Alps, higher than any European was known to have gone before. Looking out across the neighbouring mountains, Humboldt might have felt a supreme satisfaction. He did not. Gazing upwards with a sense of mournful solitude, he could only watch as the mist closed in once again. It was 1 o'clock in the afternoon. He and his companions turned and began to climb down. Arriving back in Europe 2 years later, Humboldt doubted whether his near ascent of Chimborazo was of serious scientific interest. In a place where flora and fauna were largely absent, and the finest instruments prone to error, the efforts of travelling natural philosophers were, in his view, scarcely rewarded. There is, on the other hand, an active popular participation in such endeavours, offered Humboldt. That which seems unobtainable has a mysterious attractive power. Humboldt embarked on a European lecture tour, recounting all he had learned on his great voyage, to find that his
sample complete. Ready to continue?